oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now set. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. Today, the court has five culprits on its oral submission docket. Cases have been settling recently, but they end today, and we'll hear 3 in the morning and 2 in the afternoon. In the order in which they'll be heard, they are as follows. Richard L. Shepard and Alan Graham versus Lahoma Ledford from Tarrant County. Transamerican National Gas Corporation and others versus Nancy Flintus from Zapata County. Cynthia Lee Dawson Austin versus William Franklin Austin from Dallas County. B. Mill Latham and others versus Ernest M. Castillo and others from Nueces County. And Hammerly Oaks Incorporated versus Darrell Edwards from Harris County. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between each of the arguments, except after the third argument when we'll take a lunch break. These arguments are being recorded by our clerk, and you may purchase a tape of the argument by talking with the clerk. Justice Abbott will not be here today, but he will participate in the deliberation and decision of these cases. Justice Heck will be here shortly. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Shepard v. Ledford.
May it please the court, Ms. Jennifer Andrews will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes.
May it please the Honorable Court. The question before the Court today is whether the Fort Worth Court of Appeals correctly held that Article 1.91B of the Family Code impermissibly restricts a medical malpractice claimant's right to file a medical malpractice claim under Article 4590I, Section 10.01. For several reasons, we believe that the Court of Appeals was incorrect in the ruling. The first reason is that Section 1.91B of the Family Code does not conflict with Section 10.01. They both address different subject matters and address different rights. Secondly, the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, at its opinion at page 8 of the slip opinion, indicated, and the implicit assumption is in its holding, is that the plaintiff in this case, Mrs. Ledford, only had one avenue, that being filing of her medical malpractice case, in which to assert her status as a wife. As I believe I would be able to show the court, both of these assumptions, as well as this court's articulated approval of the limitations period under 1.91B, mandate that the Court of Appeals be reversed and the case rendered.
Ms. Andrews, I'm concerned about the stipulation, the statement of stipulation that Lahoma Ledford and John Ledford had a valid common law marriage prior to and at the time of John Ledford's death. Why have you not waived this issue?
One particular and very important reason, Justice Gonzalez, as the court will note all through the transcript up through today, we have never contended that the Ledfords did not have a valid common law marriage. As the court will see in our motions for summary judgment, which are found at page 62, the first motion for summary judgment that was found at page 62, and the second one that was filed prior to trial, there has been never any contention that they could not prove up the elements of their common law.
That's not what it says. It says they had a valid common law marriage before and after. They didn't say anything about the elements.
The import of that stipulation, Justice Gonzalez, was, as I stated in the motion for summary judgment, had the stipulation indicated that they proved up her marriage, or she proved up her marriage within a year after the death of Mr. Ledford, then, in fact, I would have waived our affirmative defense limitation. But, as I will point out to the court and have in my brief, the stipulation can only be construed in light of the attitude of the parties, the pleadings, and the entire intent surrounding that the time that the stipulation was entered. As I pointed out, that the, we never contended that they couldn't establish a common law marriage. What we always contended, what she, and she admitted in request for admission, was that she didn't prove it up within a year. And my motions for summary judgment on file, in my verified denial before the court, a transcript of page 367, in my motions for directed verdict, my objections to the charge, my motion for judgment NOV, and through the, to today, I have never contended that she either didn't have a common law marriage or couldn't prove it up. What I have contended all along is that she failed to meet her limitation statute, and that was the import of the stipulation entered into. And the court has to look at all the circumstances and the intent of the parties. I would refer the court to the Jackson versus Lewis case, which is an older case, but in that particular instance, the I believe the defendant stipulated as to the reasonableness and necessity of medical expenses, and then the jury, so that they could be admitted, and then the jury entered a damage award of zero. The plaintiff argued that that stipulation proved up his damages and he was entitled to that. Just in this situation, the plaintiff in that case attempted to take the stipulation one step further than what the stipulation actually admitted.
Doesn't your stipulation, though, undermine the reason for Section 1.19 of the Family Code? That is, because of the legislature's hostility or reluctance to recognize common law marriages and because of the difficulties inherent in the proof of common law marriages, this limitation, they've established this limitation. But if you conceded that it, in fact, existed, what's the purpose for barring the claim?
The purpose of barring the claim is that at the time and at the instance or at the moment that Mrs. Ledford filed her lawsuit in 1991, I believe in November, she could not assert her standing. And that is what we have prosecuted all through the trial of this case and through the appellate process. The, as we, and again, I wish to reiterate what I said to Justice Gonzalez, Justice Cornyn, the, we never took the position at all that she couldn't have proven it. Unlike, as I understand it, another case here today, there's a question of whether or not there was a valid common law marriage even in existence.
You, in fact, agreed she was the common law wife.
I don't believe that there was any dispute prior to the death that they, that she could have proven it up. That was
let me be sure I understand. Is there a stipulation that she was the common law wife?
Yes, we stipulated that.
So it's not just a matter of not disputing it. You agreed that she is.
We agreed that prior to her death, she could have met, as the stipulation indicates, and I believe that as all of the record surrounding the stipulation indicates, that she and her husband lived as common law married and were common law married in Texas prior to his death. However, the stipulation doesn't recite that she therefore was precluded or never had to prove up her relationship within the one-year period or that she was never required to meet the statute under 1.91.
Why isn't the stipulation a substitute for proof?
Because I have all along, we've all along taken the position in this case that whether or not the relationship existed is separate and apart from whether or not they were able or did prove up the relationship within the records of time period. And that is what the formal element of proof, which was not disputed as a matter of law because Mrs. Ledford admitted in her request for admission at the trial court level that she in fact was common law married, that she in fact did not commence any civil, judicial, or administrative proceeding in any court in the 1 year, or no one did on her behalf either.
Does your argument depend on our construing that statute as a statute of limitations as opposed to a statute regarding evidentiary matters?
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, I believe that Justice Gonzalez in the Russell case clearly stated, and this court in Mosler as well has indicated that 1.91b is a statute of limitations.
But if we were to hold otherwise, to hold, otherwise in this case, do you lose, or is there some other argument that you have that's not dependent on our same, a limitation statute as opposed to an evidentiary?
I'm not entirely sure I understand the import of the thrust of your question. I apologize.
If the statute is designed to preclude proof in a proceeding of a common law marriage more than 1 year after the relationship ended, as opposed to limitations, do you lose, or is there some other argument that you have that's not based on the statute being a statute of limitations per se?
I believe the only answer I can have at this point, Your Honor, is the way that 1.91A has been construed, which is the part of the statute that establishes how a common law marriage may be established. In answer to your question, to the best I can answer it, I don't believe that 1.91B can be construed in any other manner but a statute of limitations.
But my question is, if we disagree with you and it's not a limitation, we say it's not a statute of limitations, it's merely it's a standard by which you can object to the introduction of evidence in a proceeding. If we hold that, do you have any other arguments why your stipulation doesn't basically mean that you stipulate yourself out of the case?
Yes, in the respect that as the legislature has recently amended, or 2 years, a year and a half ago, amended 1.91B to extend that time period. Again, I'm trying to respond to your question because I believe that the legislature made it quite clear under section, or the historical note under section C, 2C, that even though a cause of action may be, and I'm talking about the amended act, mm-hmm. even though the cause of action may be filed on or after the effective date of the amended act in 1995, if the claim was time barred prior to the act, then even if cause of action were subsequently filed attempting to assert the benefits of the extended period, the claimant still could not do so. And so from that...
But under the new act, it's a rebuttal presumption. It's not a limitation, is it?
Correct. But I think that the new act also serves as a limitations period because if they do not commence their action until after the anniversary of the two-year period, then I think that the construction of that particular statute as amended would serve as a continued or an additional statute of limitations. So I don't think that 1.91B can be construed anything but a limitations in the proof aspect, as this court in Russell noted and has spent a lot of time in talking about the proof aspect in 1.91A and the changes the legislature made in that both have to be construed as a limitation statute in that respect.
In your remaining moments, could you speak to why you're entitled to recover under the survival statute?
Would you like me to address, I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
The survival statute.
Several reasons. In the first place, Mr. Ledford died intestate. Therefore, the persons entitled to take under his estate were determined by descent and distribution. If Mrs. Ledford is not his wife, going back to the family law issue, then she certainly would not be an heir under the survival statute. But that is basically subsumed in the argument about the family code. I will not address that particular instance. Do you want me to talk about the family code issue in that respect or with respect to the...
duty to take out an administrator.
Yes, thank you. The way I read the probate code under section 178 is that an administration is deemed necessary if two or more debts exist. As the Fort Worth Court of Appeals held in the McAdams case, it didn't really per se hold that, but the holding can be construed to mean that if, in fact, debts continue to exist at the death, and certainly up until the time limitations runs on the underlying claim, which would be, in our case, 2 years, the fact that an administration was deemed necessary mandated that a personal administration be taken out and a personal administrator be appointed. There wasn't any dispute in this case that Mrs. Ledford was suing as an heir. And under our and under this court's decision in Frazier v. Lynn, I think it's 72, the court held that in the time period necessary in order to take out an administration, which is 4 years under the statute, if heirs plead and prove that no administration is necessary, then they may sue and prosecute the claim as heirs on behalf of the estate. Our contention all along was that Mrs. Ledford did not plead, and the court, as the court is probably aware, allowed a trial amendment or refused a trial amendment, and the Fort Worth Court of Appeals reversed that aspect of the case. Held that under the family settlement doctrine, applicable to wills, Mrs. Ledford could, in fact, prosecute the claim. We believe that the evidence adduced at trial established that there was at least two deaths, if not more, existing up through death and time of trial, so as to preclude her ability to prosecute the claim as the heir. And that is why we believe the estate claim should have been, or the JNOV should have been affirmed by the Fort Worth Court of Appeals.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Martha Kenning and Ms. William Newman, to present argument for the respondent. Ms. Kenning will open the
discussion. May it please the court, counsel, and members of the courtroom. We believe that Mrs. Ledford had standing to bring her wrongful death and survival action, and believe that the Court of Appeals was correct in its decision that the stipulation obviated any need to have a statute of limitations applicable to the case, and further that the notwithstanding any other law provision under 4590I prevails over a statute of limitations provision such as 1.91B of the Texas Family Code. We also believe that relevant to this issue is the legislative history with regard to the passage of this provision of 1.91B. The bill was introduced by Representative Patricia Hill, and the original intent was to do away with common law marriages altogether in the state of Texas. That provision wasn't condoned by the other members of the Congress, and they eventually worked out this compromise wherein the one-year provision to assert claims was adopted. In the legislative history, the Congresswoman Hill kept asserting that this would not affect agreements already established and that it was not the intent to dissolve marriages that were already considered common law marriages. Her intent was to prevent what she perceived as an injustice in that the case law had this presumption that there was an agreement to be married, even though there was not an actual agreement and there was conflicting testimony on other sides. She wanted to make it more difficult to prove up a common law marriage, and that was indeed done. If you construe this 1.91B as an evidentiary requirement and not a statute of limitations, think Mrs. Ledford also has to prevail.
There wouldn't be any conflict with the statute of limitations if it were merely an evidentiary requirement, as you put it?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that's correct. I believe in this case, and what was stated in the committee sessions and in the House and the Senate when they were debating this bill, is that what they wanted to do was to clarify people's marriages, and they didn't want to dispute about what was marriage and what wasn't. For parties that had agreed to be married and there was no dispute about that, I don't believe the legislature intended to have this provision apply. And I have provided pieces of the legislative history in the transcript on pages 288 through 303, and you can take a look at that. In addition, there are some tapes of those hearings in which it was debated. Why is it that we want to pass House Bill 588, which eventually wound up to be 1.91B and 1.91A of the Family Code?
Even if you're correct, the effect, let's say, of parties who considered themselves to be common law husband and wife, if they separated, if they didn't seek to somehow establish the fact of their common law marriage within a year, they would be barred thereafter from proving that, wouldn't that be the result?
That seems to be the result, Your Honor.
So to that extent, there would be a disruption of the status quo by passage of this statute in the sense that it would limit the party's right to prove the fact of a common law marriage.
If it's construed as statute of limitations, I believe you're correct, Your Honor. If it's just a merely an evidentiary point, perhaps not.
I don't understand the distinction you're making, though. If you're seeking to establish the fact that you are a spouse of a person for purposes of asserting some other claim, is that a statute of limitation to your mind? Or is that a question of legal standing to assert a claim?
I believe it's more a question of legal standing than it is anything else. I think what the legislature wanted to do was to make it a little bit more clear who were married and who were not under the common law provisions of Texas as they stood from the origins of Texas and Texas jurisprudence. Representative Hill, who sponsored the bill and argued for this bill quite a lot in the history of this bill, Her concern was, well, the way the courts are interpreting common law marriages now, one side can get up and say there was a common law marriage and the other say there wasn't, and there was still this presumption in favor of the marriage. She wanted to do away with that. And in this case, we just don't have a dispute. We don't have, the family members didn't dispute it. We have affidavits by Mrs. Ledford and John Leppard's brother and sister-in-law in the case that say we thought they were married in our eyes. We presented proof also in response to the various motions for summary judgment, which are part of the transcript in this case, that Mr. and Mrs. Ledford filed income taxes together using the names John and Lahoma Ledford. There was a title for an 88 Chevrolet pickup truck in John and Lahoma's name. Mrs. Ledford was responsible for the medical bills of Mr. Ledford after he passed away. They acted as a man and wife in this case, and I don't think it would be just to consider them elsewise. We just don't think that 1.91B applies in this case because...
Ms. Henning?
Yes, sir.
If Part B is a limitation statute, is it an affirmative defense?
I would believe it is, but I think...
And then if it's an affirmative defense, can't everything you say be true and still apply to bar her claim?
I think what's key in this case...
Isn't that the nature of an affirmative defense?
I think what's key in this case, Justice Baker, is that it says, in a proceeding under the section in which a party seeks to establish a common law marriage, it says, specifically the wording is, a proceeding in which a marriage is to be proved under this section. I think you have to look at that as...
Well, let me ask you this. If that, follow that out, what do you do with the fact that Part A says an administrative proceeding? Are there any administrative proceedings in family law cases?
I'm not aware of administrative proceedings in family law.
Does the word any cause you any problem to make it broader than what your argument is?
Well, this provision is situated in the marital provisions in the family law code. I think it was intended to apply to cases where a marriage was involved and not, I don't think it was ever intended.
Well, isn't the fact of whether she was married or not rather intimately involved in this whole case? Because if they were not, then she has no right to recover. Is that correct?
It would be true. If she was not the common law spouse of Mr. Lesberg, she would have no right to recover. It would be a standing.
So under a plain reading, can't you say that the proceeding where the issue of her marriage is important and therefore she's required to prove it within 1 year of the second part?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, there's an exception. Mrs. Lesberg never sought to prove it up in this.
Well, even if she did, if it's limitations, then it was not proved up within a year, which is what the other side argues.
If that's how the statute is construed, it is true. She did not follow any action.
I'm not clear either on your other argument that it's an evidentiary matter under Part B. What is the basis of that argument?
Well, the basis of that argument is... If the legislature did not intend to abolish common law marriages, what was it that it really intended to do by attaching this one-year provision in here? It seems to me that if you apply it in a proceeding where a marriage is sought to be proved up for example, a divorce proceeding, then it would seem to me that you would have to apply from when the relationship ended, as is stated here. I'm not quite sure I'm answering your question, Your Honor.
Well, you haven't yet, no ma'am.
You're asking me, as I understand it...
What's the rationale for making the conclusion that this Part B is an evidentiary issue rather than a limitation?
Because of the wording in the statute that says any proceeding in which a marriage is to be proved, that seems to me to be an evidentiary matter, and maybe you shouldn't take this provision as a statute of
limitations. Well, but doesn't then the rest of Part A tell you what your evidentiary requirements are? Doesn't Part B tell you the time that you have to do it with?
It says, commence not later than 1 year after the date on which the relationship ended.
So it's your better argument that 4590I trumps because of the phrase, any other law?
That is one of my arguments, Your Honor. I don't know whether it's my best argument.
It doesn't have more rationale than what you're trying to argue now.
Well, maybe I'm not getting my point across very well. My rationale is that Mrs. Wilhelma Lesberg was just never seeking to establish her marriage under this section of the family law code, and therefore it just shouldn't apply to her. She was married in Oklahoma. Oklahoma has its own set of laws under which a common law marriage is deemed a common law marriage. She went over to the state of Texas following her marriage in Oklahoma under the common laws there, and assumed she still had a valid common law marriage in the state of Texas. Therefore, we believe that she never sought to establish her marriage under this provision had she had to prove it out.
Well, but doesn't the fact that they raise Section B require her to at least show that she did something within 1 year of the date of his death under the Part B.
Under the facts of this case, Your Honor, I don't think so because of the stipulation. We just had nothing left to prove up. There was no dispute with regard to the marriage, therefore no statute of limitation should be applicable to Ms. Blakeson.
Well, would you then agree that if it's in the property defense that you said before that it is, that they could waive it by not pleading it, which would make your argument a whole lot stronger?
It could be waived by not pleading it. However, I do have a question as to whether this was ever intended to apply to personal injury actions, wrongful death actions, or medical malpractice actions in the first place. It was never discussed in the legislature. It was never discussed outside the family law context of wedding marriage.
Well, can we presume the legislature might be able to say, when we pass this statute, it's only going to apply in family law circumstances, and that's the end of it, rather than saying any judicial, administrative, or other procedure?
They could have known.
Thank you.
The reason why they didn't is a question to me because it seems plain when you examine the legislative history in this case that it was never meant outside of the marital situations where it might come up, where there's a common law marriage and then one side wants to get a divorce. Under Texas jurisprudence, once a common law marriage is established, it's considered to have the same effect as the ceremonial marriage does. Therefore, you can't get a common law divorce. You have to institute proceedings in civil court and obtain a divorce from a common law marriage.
Henning, let's addressing your argument about this statute deals with proof of an issue and not a statute of limitations. You have a stipulation here that says Lahoma Ledford and John Ledford had a valid common law marriage. If the statute is a matter of the ability to prove the marriage as opposed to simply a statute of limitations, would that stipulation not satisfy the element of proof, regardless of the affirmative defense of the statute not being proved officially? Wouldn't this stipulation meet the element of proof necessary to have a cause of action under wrongful death in this case?
We believe it does, because there just simply wasn't any need to put on any proof after that point.
With this stipulation, would there, yes, I guess that was going to be my question. With this stipulation, would there be any requirement in the case to prove the marriage at this point?
We believe not, and we didn't, in fact, introduce any evidence with regard to the common law marriage. There was a motion in limine in this case following the stipulation in which the trial court decided that that was not an issue that needs to be raised any longer with regard to the validity of the marriage after the stipulation was signed off by counsel and entered by the judge. We believe that there's just no dispute left in which we have to put on any evidence whatsoever to establish the elements of the common law marriage, and therefore there's no reason to apply the statute of limitations because there's no dispute. You can't even bring a deck action to assert your right to a common law marriage because under the case of State v. Morales, it's just not just justiciable. You have to have something that needs to be decided in order for you to bring an action with regard to establishing your common law marriage. I would also point out that under 1.92, which is the declarations provision in the family code, it requires signatures of both spouses. You just, after the death of one spouse, you simply can't go to the court and file your declaration that you had a common law marriage. So where does that leave parties? I'm not sure that...
Would it leave them under Part 2?
I'm sorry?
If you can't get them to sign, doesn't that leave you under Part 2, which is the purpose of Part 2?
Well, I'm not sure that's what the legislature meant.
Well, that's what they said.
Well, that's how it reads, but when you look at the legislative history, and they were deciding how to word the 1.91B provision, Congressman Armbrister brought up, well, when does this become an issue? When does the marriage become in question? And that's how it was decided to use this language, when the relationship breaks up. And therefore, it's just the legislature's silent. What do you do in a case where someone dies? Is that what they meant by that? I believe that they just did not intend for this provision in the Family Code to be applied across the board to wrongful death actions and medical malpractice actions as we've got here in the case today.
You do agree it's been applied in other than divorce cases, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And those cases are just wrong?
Well, I believe that those cases never really examined the legislative intent behind 1.91B, and I think that's what we need to do in order to give the effect of what the legislature meant to do when it enacted this provision. And I think if you examine the legislative history in this case, you'll agree that it wasn't meant to apply to cases such as we have before you today.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.
But the whole time I have remained in council, I'm not sure if I have any. I'd like to address, I'm William Newman, I'm out here from Mrs. Ledford. I'd like to address Mrs. Ledford's points of error which pertain to jury selection. If the court agrees that Mrs. Ledford is the wife of John Ledford, it will also have to reach the jury selection issue which the Court of Appeals decided against us. And I think that the Court of Appeals in its decision and, for that matter, the petitioner has confused bias in its usual meaning, which is the language this court used in Compton, with bias in its legal meaning. And in Compton and in virtually all of the cases following it, including this one, the courts have quoted this court's opinion in 1963, which is that bias in its usual meaning is an inclination toward one side of an issue rather than to the other, but to disqualify it must appear that the state of mind of the juror leads to the natural inference that he will not or did not act with impartiality. It goes on to say that prejudice embraces bias, but not the converse. In this case, we have a series... Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. We have a series of relatively vague and occasionally contradictory and conflicting questions to four different jurors. Some of them are correct and some of them are not to establish legal bias. To Juror Cottle, counsel asked whether she can be fair and objective and neutral looking at the medical facts, and she agrees that she cannot. Another juror response to the same question, so you could not be fair and objective looking at the medical facts, and she said this is true. Unfortunately, that's a compound question because she goes on to ask, as they have been testified to, so that both sides start out evenly. Well, that's a juror that says that's true, but she had already been stricken for cause, so her answer is kind of meaningless. It's at that point that Mr. Garrett says, I feel the same way. To a compound question, can you be fair or do we start out even? Can you be fair establishes legal bias if you say no. Do we start out even establishes bias in its ordinary sense. And I think that's all that was established here. At best, it raises a fact issue for the trial judge, which the trial judge...
Why is this even relevant? Because it's going to be remanded for a new trial. Are you asking for rendition of judgment somehow?
Yes. I think the very least it requires... that it be remanded to the Court of Appeals for proper consideration under an abuse of discretion standard rather than as a matter of law in which it was decided.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Is it your contention that Mrs. Ledford had to file this case within a year?
No, ma'am. No, Your Honor. As I was going to point out, and which I believe is an error in assumption on the Fort Worth Court of Appeals part. There are several methods available to individuals like spouses of informal marriages in this Leslie's position, namely application for heirship, as we see what was done in the Torres case, in the Georgiadis case, a declaratory judgment action to establish the rights of the parties and establish what the relationship is.
If she'd gone into court and had a declaratory judgment that she was the wife, and then within 2 years sued, would you be able to contest that?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe I could, because she would have had a judicial determination of her status, which is what.
But you wouldn't have had an opportunity to contest it.
I would not have at that point in time, but from a practical standpoint, given the fact that she would have had a 1.91A, says any civil, judicial, or administrative proceeding, that therefore doesn't limit the person's ability to go and have their determination established. I believe in the Torres case, when the parents filed their application for heirship in the probate code in order, as I read the case, to strategically preclude the ex-maybe putative husband or whatever from seeking any additional recovery in their wrongful death state action. The apartment who had settled with the putative come-on husband were not necessarily, I'm not entirely sure of what the status of all the parties were or whether or not they were able to actually make an appearance in the probate proceeding. But I do believe that if, as 1.91A allows, that a person proves up their marriage in whatever mechanism, any civil, judicial, or administrative proceeding, or Section 1.92 affidavit form. Obviously, both former spouses have to be living in order to file that affidavit with the court or with the county. Then that would serve as an ability to assert that of the marriage relationship and preclude the issue that we're here today. And in fact, I think that that is precisely what needed to be done. Since individuals who elect to engage or enter into an informal marriage have voluntarily foregone the formal ceremonial process of getting married, and therefore eliminated the ability to track their marriage from a state public policy standpoint, then I think it is only reasonable that some mechanism be available to other parties who may have to deal with these people and on the basis of the relationship, like we do in this case, like they do in divorce actions, like in the other cases pointed out by Justice Cornyn, where 1.91B has been held determinative.
Okay, Ms. Andrews,
limitation. Yes.
Let me ask a question. What, here's the stipulation. There's a valid common law marriage. What's the mechanism at the trial of this wrongful death for you to avoid now the proof of the common law marriage?
As Justice Baker pointed out, all underlying facts about the status of this case can be true, and still my affirmative defense, which is an avoidance defense, since they didn't prove it up.
But your avoidance defense is your avoidance defense is they can't prove that they had a valid common law marriage.
Because she didn't prove it up within a year.
But she doesn't need to prove a valid common law marriage because the stipulation says she has a valid common law marriage. At the trial of this case, when the plaintiff wants to produce their evidence that will produce a judgment, if any, against the defendants here, one of the elements of proof will be a valid common law marriage. You say you have a defense. They can't prove it because they didn't bring it up in a year. But they don't have to prove it because the stipulation says they have a valid common law marriage. What you're attempting to do is say, if they come forward with proof of a common law marriage, We challenge it because it wasn't brought within a year. But that's not, they don't have to bring forth proof of common law marriage because you agree they were married common law.
Well, I think that the case cannot be looked at by this court in the absence of the entirety of the record, and that includes Mrs. Ledford's admissions, which are included in the transcript. She admits under 169 of our Rules of Civil Procedure that no civil, judicial, or administrative proceeding was brought within a year by herself or anyone on her behalf to prove up her marriage. So in light of her admission, I don't
have... So if there was an issue in the trial of the case, if there was an issue as to whether or not she had a common law marriage in the trial of the case,
she's already admitted
she could not establish it.
Right. She's already admitted she didn't follow 1.9.
But if proof of the marriage is not an issue in the case, then that circumstance would never come up.
If we didn't have an informal marriage kind of a situation, that is correct.
Under most circumstances, would a defendant have to raise this by a verified denial?
Yes, Your Honor, I did.
On the surviving spouses, do you have any dispute that all of the property of the deceased estate went to his common-law wife? Is there any dispute about that?
No, Your Honor, there is not, because assuming Mrs. Ledford is the wife under descent and distribution, since she was the only wife and there were no children of that marriage, she would inherit both personality, community, and separate property. So that is correct.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That concludes the argument and the first call. The court will now take a brief recess.
All right.